Hello. Thanks for listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show. For KVNF News, my name is Eric Gould. Here on Local Motion, we'll take a year's-end look at the Colorado River and the now 19-year-old drought in the state. On the KVNF regional newscast over the past year, we've heard stories from Luke Runyon, who reports for Rocky Mountain Community Radio Exchange member KUNC. Runyon has been filing stories on the Colorado River for the past year and will do so again next year as part of a grant. He covers issues involved with the drought and moves all around the Southwest, telling some of the stories of the more than 40 million people whose lifestyles rely upon the Colorado River. To get caught up on his most recent reporting, here's the story Luke Runyon filed last week about the recent National Climate Assessment Report.
Climate scientists say with very high confidence that warm temperatures are reducing mountain snowpack, an important water source for tens of millions of Americans. The changing climate is also leading to more intense droughts, increasing the risk of flooding, weakening key infrastructure projects, and depleting groundwater. Without coming up with new ways to manage water and cut greenhouse gas emissions, the report's authors say existing gaps between water supplies and demands in the desert Southwest will only continue to grow. I'm Luke Runyon.
When KVNF News spoke with Runyon last week, we started out asking him to talk a little bit about what the National Climate Assessment Report said and how it reflects the past year in drought history.
Yeah, so this is a really lengthy report from the White House about the wide-ranging effects of climate change, and it focused on regions throughout the U.S. and then focused in also on a few distinct industries and natural resources within the United States and looking at how climate change might have an effect on those. And so because I cover water and the Colorado River Basin, I was really looking at the chapters on water and the Southwest U.S. And in the chapter on the Southwest, climate scientists were pretty unequivocal. They were saying with really high confidence that the warming temperatures that we're seeing are going to and are already reducing the water content of snowpack that we see in the southern Rocky Mountains. And that in turn is translating into lower flows in rivers and streams that depend on that melting snow. And I think one thing that really crystallizes what that chapter was talking about is that when you opened up the landing page, you had this photo of low water levels at Lake Mead, which is the nation's largest reservoir, and that's just outside of Las Vegas. And it kind of is the perfect symbol of the ongoing water challenges that are going to be seen in the Southwest as we go forward. You could also, as the chapter went on, you could also see increased evaporation from those reservoirs as well as rivers and streams themselves. You could see damage to water infrastructure, even increasing the risk of some flash flooding throughout the Southwest. And I think just in general, you're going to be seeing more water scarcity in the Southwest as climate change goes forward. And really the message that I think the big takeaway was from the climate report was that climate change is not some sort of far-off problem off into the future that future generations are going to have to deal with. These are problems that are already happening right now, and that there is still some time to make big changes to our economy and energy sectors in order to curb some of these negative effects, but it's going to take a lot of work in order to get there.
That was Luke Runyon, and this is Local Motion on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. Here on Local Motion, we're talking about the Colorado River, the drought, and a year's-end review of stories we've played about the warming climate as it changes the river. When hearing about the National Climate Assessment Report, and after seeing the impacts of the drought in the West, Runyon gained a perspective that few get to see. Over time, he said, he realized that his stories were about more than just the Colorado River.
A big thing that I've taken away from covering the Colorado River as a beat for a year is it's really easy to see water as a symbol for something in discussions in the West. Water is something that sort of represents people's values in the Western United States, and how people use water, whether that's for growing grass on their lawn or for irrigating crops or for growing a garden or for having a swimming pool or a golf course. All of these things are, they're values-based, and it's really easy in discussions about water in the West to start pointing fingers at each other and saying, well, you're not being a good steward of the water that is so scarce and so precious. And then in those discussions, they tend to break down once you start pointing fingers about who's using water the best and who's being the most just in their use of water. And I just don't think that that's a great way to have a conversation about this. But that was that's something that, as I've covered it more and more, you see pop up in discussions about water, is that it is really symbolic. And people, when you start threatening people's water supplies, they feel that in their guts, because water is so essential to life itself. Once you start messing with it and moving it around to places where it doesn't naturally occur, it sort of hits people in a different part of their gut than I think a lot of other issues.
It's easy to get dire and make some pretty dire predictions about the future. I just wonder, are you optimistic that the Colorado River will be able to fulfill all the needs of its 40 million users in the years to come?
I think that's really hard to say, because I think you can easily make an argument now that the Colorado River is already not able to meet all of the needs of the people and the wildlife and the ecosystems that depend on it. We're at a point right now in the Colorado River Basin where more water exists on paper in the form of these really broad multi-state agreements than actually exists in the river and the reservoirs themselves that we've built throughout the Southwest. And every drop of water from the Colorado River is already claimed by someone. So I think going forward, if you want to feel optimistic about it, you have to look at elected and appointed leaders throughout the Southwest to be the ones who rein in water use throughout the Southwest to sort of bridge that gap that we have right now between the water supply and the water demands throughout the entire basin. Really, this is a problem that you can fix with policy and incentives and civic activism within local communities. It's just whether or not there's enough political will to make all of that possible. And a lot of that comes with crisis. And a lot of people would say the Colorado River is already in crisis. Some people would say it's going to be in crisis in a few years. And those are the kinds of moments that can catalyze these large agreements between states in order to rein in their water use. So I'm not in total despair about the fate of the Colorado River, but it definitely has some really serious challenges ahead.
Thanks for listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. Here on Local Motion, our weekly public affairs show, we're interviewing KUNC reporter Luke Runyon about the past year he spent covering the Colorado River and issues involved with the drought. If you imagine the Colorado River as a plumbing system, Lake Mead and Lake Powell are kind of like bathtubs. They store the Colorado River as it flows toward the Pacific, and they fuel dams that provide electricity for much of the Southwest. A big part of the news this past year was the development of a mitigation plan that involves taking water out of Blue Mesa Reservoir, the Flaming Gorge, and other Colorado reservoirs, and then banking that water in Lakes Mead and Powell to guarantee that they will never run dry. Agreement upon and implementation of this plan is still a couple of years away.
So that's part of a really broad agreement among all the states that use the Colorado River, the seven states, and they're called drought contingency plans. These are plans that have been in the works for probably 3 or 4 years, and the general thrust of these plans is a broad recognition among water managers that the path that they're on right now is not sustainable, and if they stay on this path, those big reservoirs are going to crash to a point where hydropower wouldn't be able to be generated at Hoover Dam or Glen Canyon Dam. And then even further, they could crash to a point where you wouldn't be able to even push water through the system. The reservoirs would be so low, they'd be at, quote, Deadpool levels. So that's the big concern, is that these big reservoirs would crash. And so each of the plans are sort of different. You have a lower basin plan that's in progress right now, and that's between California, Arizona, and Nevada. And that plan is really looking at reining in water use. And then you have the upper basin plan, which is Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico. And those plans are looking at a few different options for keeping those reservoirs full. One is that this concept that you brought up, that this sort of stocking of the big reservoirs. And this is adding some flexibility and some communication among the states and the Bureau of Reclamation, which a lot of times will operate these reservoirs and dams. And so this would be an idea that if Lake Powell is getting to a really critical level, that some of these upper basin reservoirs would release more water in order to fill Lake Powell up. Another prong of the plan that was really controversial was this concept of demand management. And basically what that means is figuring out a way to use less water. And a lot of times those conversations immediately pivot to farmers because agriculture uses the vast majority of water within the basin. And farmers were feeling pretty nervous that if push came to shove, they would lose some of their water allocations. If you know, growing cities were needing water supplies, that they would see their water supplies taken from them in some way. And so coming up with a plan of how to cut water use and how to do it fairly, and so that people don't feel like something is being taken from them that they've had for, you know, generations, these water rights, those are really tricky discussions to have. But water managers are getting to a point now where they might have a plan kind of coalescing. The Upper Basin has finished its plan and is ready to sign. The big disagreements have been happening in the Lower Basin, where honestly, like, the tension is a lot higher than it is in the Upper Basin. And they have not been able to come to an agreement. The federal government gave water managers until the end of this year to finish something. It's looking increasingly likely that they're going to blow past that deadline. But the water leaders there say they're getting close. So I would say probably early 2019 is when you're looking at something maybe getting finished.
And I just wondered, as a follow-up, what is the current condition of water levels in Powell and Meade the last time you saw them?
Incredibly low as well. And actually, if earlier this year, the Bureau of Reclamation put out some new data that was adding up the biggest reservoirs within the Colorado River's upper basin. And they're collectively at the lowest point that they've been since they were filled. Both Powell and Meade are incredibly low. Meade isn't at its lowest point that it's ever been, but it's pretty dang close. And there's a fear that if this winter doesn't produce as much snow as is needed, that those reservoirs could drop even further. And in the case of Meade, there's a lot of agreements that are tied to the level of Lake Meade. So if Meade drops to a certain level, it sort of knocks over some of these dominoes where you could have the federal government starting to get more involved in water management in the West, which a lot of states don't really want to see.
And let's take a look at the Colorado River Compact real quickly. You've done stories about that. It's basically an outdated agreement between seven states that dictates who gets the water in the Colorado River. And while it is largely agreed that the compact does not take into consideration modern-day drought conditions, it's unlikely that it will ever get renegotiated. Why is that?
The Colorado River Compact, I think some people would argue that it's definitely not outdated and that we need to stick with it. But it was an agreement that was signed among all seven states that rely on the river back in 1922 in Santa Fe, and it parsed out the water from the Colorado River. And the conventional wisdom about the compact is that it was signed at a point and was using data at a point when the river was flowing at a really historic high. There was, these water managers were going into these meetings thinking, we have a lot of water to work with. And then soon after they signed it, it returned to this lower, more regular flow, the flow that we know now. And so right from the beginning, you had this disconnect between the amount of water that exists in these agreements and then the amount of water that actually exists in reality. So there is broad recognition that there is bad math within the compact. But figuring out how to fix that math and who will have to bear the brunt of figuring out that math problem, that is where the conversation often breaks down. Because going back into the compact would be a very painful process, potentially, for some of the smaller states within the Colorado River Basin. If you talk to water managers in the upper basin, people in Wyoming and Utah and Colorado, they say opening the compact back up would mean that their states would lose their water allocations, that they would get less water because the population mostly exists in the lower basin, in places like Los Angeles and Phoenix and Las Vegas, that those places would be the ones who would throw their political clout around during a renegotiation and get more water from the Colorado River. I don't know how true that is, but that's the fear that a lot of upper basin water managers have. And so that's why the compact will most likely never be renegotiated. Instead, they like to do these sort of patches, these band-aids on the compact in order to renegotiate, not renegotiate the compact, but do these new agreements. Instead of reopening this compact, you can make fixes among the states rather than going back in and changing everything, which would be intractably difficult.
Thanks for listening to Local Motion here on KVNF. We've been speaking with Luke Runyon about the Colorado River and his coverage of drought issues around the state. Now let's hear what Luke said was one of his favorite stories from this past year. A so-called water sheriff talks about how water law impacts farmers and ranchers on the ground in Cortez.
One morning a few years ago, Dave Hune got a call. The woman on the other end was frantic, screaming as she watched her 82-year-old husband in the yard.
And he was being beaten with a shovel by his 86-year-old neighbor.
The fight was over water. One of the men accused the other of taking more than his share from their irrigation ditch, leaving less for everyone else.
You had two old-timers that were very stubborn and very hard-headed, and they were bound and determined to do it their way, and the other party was saying, no, you won't.
Hune is a sheriff's deputy in Montezuma County, Colorado, in the Four Corners, tasked with enforcing the state's complex water law. He's probably the only deputy in the state with this kind of job, making sure water goes where it's supposed to.
We've seen some really inventive ways this year for stealing water.
So how do they do it? Well, one method, drop a pump into an irrigation ditch, turn it on, and if you don't have the water rights to do that, it's a crime. Method number two, you have rights to water, but not a lot, so you take more than you're allowed.
Cortez MC-209.
Inside his black Ford pickup, Hune says when he started handing out tickets for water theft, it didn't go over well.
First, people were shocked. They were like, you're kidding me, right? You're gonna cite me over water? It's like, yes, it's a valuable commodity in this state.
Hello there.
76-year-old farmer Bob Schuster knows all about water thieves. He grows wine grapes and hay and runs a plumbing supply store in the county's biggest city of Cortez. He's dressed in denim overalls, sporting a black and gray beard. Schuster says droughts make people desperate.
People are basically, and these are good people, basically dishonest.
Schuster's farm is at the end of an irrigation ditch with several users upstream. If they're taking more water than they're entitled to, it dries up before it reaches his crops.
They look out their fields, they see they need water, and they take the water going through, it's not theirs.
And it's common for emotions to run high in these disputes. He says he's had guns pointed at him, shovels swung at his head, and been sucker punched in fights with neighbors over water.
Sheriff's Office, may I help you?
Back at the office, Hune says violent skirmishes have declined since the county started enforcing water law. But it's a fragile piece.
Historically, we've had people killed over water in the state of Colorado. We have in this county.
Hune is on patrol in a part of the country where climate change is likely to make water even more scarce than it is now.
We don't want the fighting between families and between friends. We want to be able to resolve it in a nonviolent way.
And as his community dries out, Hune knows he'll be spending more time, not less, keeping fights over water from blowing up.
In your experience covering the depleting water supply, working with farmers, talking to people who rely on this water every day, would you say that the laws are sufficient to guarantee that there will be enough water for everyone?
Oh man, that's tricky. I think it depends on who you talk to. I think if you talk to farmers who own old water rights, they would say they love the system that we're under right now because they have a lot of power in the form of older water rights. And our system of water law in the West gives more value to older water rights. It's all based on when you showed up and claimed your water right. If you talk to some cities who rely on water rights that are lesser in priority, that are newer, they might not love the system that we're under as much because their supplies are more threatened under the system of water allocation that we have. So I think it all just depends on which perspective you're coming at it with. If you're a farmer, you love the system that we're in. If you have a newer water right or you're trying to file for a new right, you probably don't love the system that we're under right now.
And our final question for you today, in terms of moving forward, you know, what happens now? Do we just cross our fingers and hope for a wet winter?
That's what a lot of people are doing right now. I think a lot of the focus is going to be on these drought contingency plans because that's what people are working on right now. And they really will sort of set out the future, at least for the next, 5 or 10 years, about what Colorado River water management is going to look like. And that'll be an ongoing process. Again, these are just plans. There's nothing set in stone necessarily about how Colorado River water management happens. There's no one single agency that directs how the Colorado River's water is allocated and divvied up and managed. It's a group of water management agencies throughout the Southwest that decide that future. But that's one thing that I'm definitely going to be watching pretty closely as those plans come together.
And we've been speaking with Luke Runyon. He's a reporter from KUNC who for the past year or so has been working on issues about the Colorado River and the drought in the Southwest. Luke, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks.
And last, here on Local Motion, we'll hear the latest story in our Connect the Drops series. Beer and wine made from purified wastewater are offering the public exposure to a type of water reuse with the potential to reshape water consumption in Colorado. Hannah Lee Myers explores water reuse.
Colorado is known for its adventurous and innovative microbrew industry.
Cheers.
But the beer served in October at the Recycled Water Fest southeast of Denver takes that reputation to a whole new level. This beer and the wine on offer was made with water taken from a wastewater treatment plant.
So this is Centurion. It is a Pilsner.
Asta Parker is a water reuse technologist with Corollo Engineers. In early 2018, she participated in the Pure Water Colorado Demonstration Project, a collaborative pilot program intended to prove that a rarely used 5-part water purification system can turn contaminated used water into so-called potable water that's clean enough to drink. Parker says the treatment method the project utilized isn't new, but the circumstances surrounding the project are unique.
This treatment train has only been used once before, actually in a project in Florida. This is the first one that was done in the winter and the first one that was done in a completely landlocked state.
And turning that reused water into beer and wine is a tactic members of the project and members of the industry, like drinking water technologist Tyler Nading, say is hugely helpful in convincing the public reused drinking water is nothing to be concerned about.
No one is going to say no to a glass of wine or a glass of beer, right? We're all okay drinking that and having a nice time. So when we normalize drinking reused water in the context of beer and wine, it makes normalizing it in the context of drinking water much easier.
Colorado's been purifying and reusing wastewater for non-potable uses, like irrigation and power generation, since the 1970s. But President of Water Reuse Colorado, Allegra Da Silva, says expanding water recycling into the realm of potable uses is a necessary next step in addressing the Colorado Water Plan's projection that the state will face a water shortage of up to 560,000 acre-feet per year by 2050.
We're looking for some more golf courses to hook up for recycled water, or maybe one or two more power plants. It's just not going to get us there. The only way we can approach several hundred thousand acre feet per year is some pretty innovative approaches, including potable reuse.
Da Silva says as the threat of water scarcity grows, so is municipal interest in water reuse. The town of Castle Rock on the Front Range is at the front of the charge towards municipal water reuse infrastructure, with a potable reuse system scheduled for completion in 2020. Water Resources Manager for Castle Rock Water, Matt Binnock, says they're aggressively embracing water reuse out of necessity.
We're trying to wean ourselves off the deep Denver Basin aquifer water that Castle Rock has been so reliant on for years and years and years. And that's a depleting resource. So what we want to do is to try to use water that comes from snowmelt, but also use water that comes from the deep Denver Basin and reuse that over time.
But due to a variety of state laws dictating what kind of water can be used and from where, not all municipalities will have the water rights necessary to do what Castle Rock is planning. As University of Denver Associate Professor of Law Tom Romero explains, there's a reason Colorado's rules about water reuse are fairly strict.
Unlike many of our downstream neighbors, we're limited as a headwater state. We do have to deliver a big chunk of that water to our downstream neighbors, because if we are in deficit, we all pay in one way or the other.
But Romero says where Colorado water law is rigid, lawmakers have the ability to be flexible.
The legislature can come in and can pilot projects. So we saw that, for instance, in the example of rainwater capture. It's a type of reuse. So these pilot projects allow us some flexibility to at least test the impact that it's going to have on the system. And so that's, I think, we're in an exciting moment to kind of see where that leads us.
The absence of any state or federal laws regulating potable water reuse is putting recycled drinking water in a sort of limbo. State and federal lawmakers are looking to pilot programs like the Pure Water Colorado Demonstration Project to help them set regulations. But water managers are hesitant to invest in water reuse infrastructure that future regulations may ultimately render obsolete or excessive. And water consumers are hesitant to get behind the idea of drinking reclaimed wastewater without regulations in place to ensure safety and purity. And that's where the beer and wine comes in. As the Recycled Water Fest comes to a close, bartender Lucas Restrepo says, judging by people's reactions to the beer and wine, water reuse advocates working to normalize reclaimed drinking water should consider the event a success.
They actually really enjoyed it. Yeah, I didn't see anyone like turned off that it was recycled water, so that's cool.
So as Colorado water managers, lawmakers, scientists, and advocates work to take big strides towards widespread potable reuse, the public is taking steps in that direction, one drink at a time. For Connecting the Drops and Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Hanley Myers.
Connecting the Drops is a collaboration between Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations and Water Education Colorado. Find out more at watereducationcolorado.org. Support is provided by CoBank, which provides financing solutions for rural water systems. Find out more at cobank.com.
And that was Local Motion on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.